Ready to soundtrack your summer? With Red Bull Summer All Day Play, you choose a playlist that fits your summer vibe the best. Are you a festival fanatic, a deep end DJ, a road dog, or a trail mixer? Just add a song to your chosen playlist and put your summer on track. Red Bull Summer All Day Play. Red Bull gives you wings. Visit redbull.com/brightsummerahead to learn more. See you this summer.
Experience a membership that backs what you're building with American Express Business Platinum. Get 2x membership rewards points per dollar on eligible purchases in key business categories, as well as on each eligible purchase of $5,000 or more, on up to $2 million in eligible purchases per calendar year. American Express Business Platinum. There's nothing like it. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/business-platinum.
In April rain, to wash away.
Welcome to a new edition of the Neon Jazz Interview Series with 9-time Grammy-nominated jazz vocalist Tierney Sutton. We caught up with this acclaimed musician about her new 2026 album, Spring, done with stellar pianist Tamir Hendelman, along with taking a look behind the curtain of a jazz career full of magic and good lore. She has earned a place amongst the most revered voices in contemporary jazz and is renowned as a master storyteller and one of the finest interpreters of the great American songbook. Over her career, her recordings reflect on expansive musical curiosity, bringing her singular voice to works by composers ranging from Gershwin, Jobim, and Bill Evans to modern icons such as Sting and Joni Mitchell. Spring is her 17th album as a leader or co-leader and first voice and piano duo project. While the Tierney Sutton Band has been a mainstay on the international jazz scene for nearly 30 years, she has long been drawn to the intimacy of smaller settings. On Spring, she captures the freedom, immediacy, and spontaneity that defined her duo performances. From her base in Los Angeles, we get into a great look into a legendary career. Enjoy this interview.
It's great to meet you. I'm looking forward to getting into Spring, and I want to begin our conversation with this. 6 years ago, this pandemic was a real shapeshifter for all of us, especially musicians. How did you get through that era, and how has it influenced the way that you create and live today?
That's a great, great question, and it is very, very relevant to Spring. The pandemic had a huge effect on me in a lot of ways, but one of the most enduring ways for what's going on right now with me is that it cemented a relationship with Tamir Hendelman, the pianist with whom I recorded Spring. Tamir is he's a genius, and I've worked with a lot of great musicians, my band is full of great musicians. I get to work with great musicians and have for the 30 years I've been doing this. But Tamir is his own creation, his own kind of special thing. And I've always had a special relationship with Tamir working duo. And the duo relationship, I think that all of jazz is really about the conversation and the coming together of the individual musicians. It's something I feel very strongly about, that it's not a music that's really about the individual stars, although it is.
This podcast is brought to you by Carvana. Selling your car should feel like one less thing on your list, not one more. With Carvana, it is. Just go to Carvana.com, enter your license plate or VIN, and get a real offer down to the penny. No back and forth, no surprises, just an experience you can trust. Like your offer? Accept it. Schedule a pickup, and we'll come to you with a check in hand. Your car, your timeline, your terms. Visit Carvana.com to sell your car today.
Carvana.
Pickup fees may apply.
But I think it's more about the relationship. Mm-hmm. The relationship of the musicians to the songs and the relationship of the musicians to one another. And I think it's a music that is about listening and asking questions more than it is about asserting yourself all the time. But specifically, in terms of the pandemic, Tamir is a person that does not stop working easily. It's not, he can't. That boy cannot do it. And so within a week of the shutdown, he was doing streaming concerts. And he was doing solo streaming concerts. And 1 week he would do the music of Chick Corea, just pulled out of his butt, like just not reading a thing here. Okay. And he just would do this virtuoso hour of all Chick Corea compositions. And then the next week he would do lesser, you know, he even knows lyrics. So he's a very deep musician. And along the way, we had started to work as a duo. We had gone to Japan. We'd been invited to Japan. We had gone to Germany. And he invited me to do one of these streaming shows. And it went so well that we did a series of them. And the last one we did at the end of 2020 was called The Seasons of Mercer. And it was all Johnny Mercer lyrics. And this was very deep for me because I was very, very close to Alan and Marilyn Bergman. And they were both still alive at that time. And I was their demo singer for 35 years. And I also, they were like my parents. I spent every holiday with them. Christmas, Thanksgiving, Passover, all of it with them. And I, of course, would consult with Alan. By this time, Marilyn was kind of not, she was failing a lot, and she had stopped writing, and she was ill enough that she wasn't really speaking much at this time.
Yeah.
She passed in 2022. But I was very close with Alan and with him a lot. And he was a deep consultant on that concert for Tamir and me because Johnny Mercer was his mentor. So that was part of the blossoming of this, that my best friends, who were kind of the inheritors of the Great American Songbook lyric tradition, were consultants, and Tamir and I would manifest these things. So that it became the most fertile working relationship that went through the pandemic.
You know, what's interesting covering jazz for this long is that it's such a wonderful world of music. And there's all these elements that I discover over time. And one of them is that this genre, there's such an interchangeability between musicians. There's all these different music. You all are busy, but if you run into each other at a gig and you figure out that it works. And what I'm trying to get at here is this. There's this level of musicians in the jazz world that quote unquote fall in love. It's not a romantic thing. It's you just don't know until you get to a room. And I hear this all the time. It's like, how did this happen? It's like we were on a gig. We just started playing and all of a sudden there were sparks. It's kind of like falling in love, you know, in
right.
this platonic music way. Right. So it's like you yeah. wouldn't know until you get into the room and exchange these sound particles.
That's a really good point. And there's a series of concerts that I started, but I sort of stopped just because I got so busy with Tamir, called Blind Dates. That it's an idea that came about at the end of the pandemic. And I'll tell you how it came about. And it was exactly what you're talking about. I was in Paris with my husband at this time. And when I got back, from Paris, I got a message from a presenter somewhere in the Midwest, maybe Boise, I don't remember, and saying, hey, listen, Cecile McLaurin-Salvant and Sullivan Fortner were supposed to do a concert in 2 weeks or in a week, and Cecile has COVID. Is there any way you could fill in, because Sullivan said that he would do it with you. And I knew Sullivan's work. I didn't really know him. Did I know him already? I think we had done the jazz. No, had we done the jazz? I think I was to meet him a little later. But anyway, I thought, oh, this would be great. But I had COVID. Yeah. I was sick. And so I had to say no. And it was supposed to be like 3 days later that I would be going to do this show. And I thought to myself, that would be the most fun thing, to just show up at this gig and say, hey, Sullivan, what songs do we both know? Let's just pick some keys and play. And so I decided to embark on a series of concerts called Blind Date. And I did the first one with Sullivan at the Duc de Lamballe in Paris about a year and a half later, or 2 years later. I met him for real on the jazz cruise, and I talked to him about it. And then I said, listen, just tell me when you're going to be in either New York, LA, or Paris, because I'm in all of these places a lot. And we'll find a time that we can do a blind date. And we found this great, and we did an evening at the Duc de Lamballe. And the rules of the blind date are, you cannot play a note together until the day of the show, okay, until the sound check. You can exchange emails. You can talk about songs that you have in common. You know, you don't have to be totally, but you cannot actually play together until that day. And it was delightful. It was really, really, really wonderful. And the first thing he said was, Cecile has talked about you being an influence on her, and I know your work, which made me weep because she's so marvelous and he's so marvelous. And he had little things. He said, do you want me to go into 3-4 on the bridge of this tune like you do with your band? And I was like, I can't believe you know that, but whatever. You do whatever you want. So I did that one. And then I did another one with Randy Brecker in New York. That one was with Christian Jacob on piano, but it was a blind date between Randy and me. And so the idea is to come together with someone whose work you've always admired and have a blind date, have a first date with them. And I'll be doing more, but I got busy with Tamir doing these duo things and so stopped doing it. But you're exactly right. There's a magic, and we spend all these years kind of knowing each other's work but never actually doing something together. And then when you have that opportunity, it's really special.
And I would imagine having that connection would reignite that initial love that you have for this music, why you got into it in the first place. And then also it kind of opens up this Pandora's box to things that you didn't know maybe was a part of your musical arsenal, that things just be. So it's the nexus and it's the future all at once.
Yes. That is the best point, because it does the same thing that teaching really great students does. Which, exactly as you say, it reminds you of how you got into it in the first place, and how you fall in love with stuff. You know, that was the one tricky thing for me about having a band for almost 30 years with the same personnel, and why it's eventually it kind of, you know, diffused and started working with different people, because you get into a kind of a groove. And it can be a rut. And I think there are things that you develop with certain people that you don't develop with other people.
Yeah.
And the more different people you can work with, the more elements of what you do can be developed. And this is what I always say to students and people that I'm coaching, is that the best thing you can do is figure out who the person you're working with is, what they do that's great. You know, write a lyric for a song they've written. Find what they are great at. Don't tell them to just come into your universe. Go into their universe. Yeah. You know, that it again, that's what jazz is. It's not, I'm the star and you're going to play my charts.
Right.
That would be the last thing that I would do on a blind date. Would be, okay, here are things I've done with Tierney Sutton Band and you're going to play them. No. No way. Yeah.
So was it always going to be music for you? Now, we talked about Milwaukee. Was that where you're from originally?
Well, I was born in Omaha, Nebraska, because my dad was in the Air Force there, but I grew up in Milwaukee.
Okay.
And I always sang, but I didn't discover jazz until I was in college. And so before that, I didn't feel like I had anything really original enough or compelling enough to offer. I sang in all the school musicals and, you know, and children's choirs and all these things. And I knew I had a decent voice, but I didn't have one of those voices. You know, I wasn't like a Liz Wright, you know, one of those people that just stands up and sings and everyone goes, oh my Lord, it's the voice of the universe. You know,
yes.
I wasn't that. And so I didn't have that feeling about my voice, for sure. And I wasn't a songwriter, or I didn't see myself as a songwriter. And I didn't want to do covers of other people's songs, because the world I grew up in, if you did covers of other people's songs, you were trying to sound as much like the radio as possible. And that didn't feel like it had integrity to me. Again, I had no idea what jazz was.
Yeah.
Then I was exposed to jazz and I said, oh, okay, this is kind of a thing. And I had a little gift for it that I didn't realize what it was, because even as a small child, I would sing to myself and do theme and variations in my own brain. And I didn't know that that was kind of improvising. I didn't know what that was. I thought it was just a tick that I had that was irrelevant. And so once I was exposed to great jazz and realized that there were all different kinds of voices, that it wasn't about copying the version on the radio. It wasn't about one version of a song. And once I started to fall in love with the architecture of the Great American Songbook, and there wasn't the one version that I was copying, I was just loving the song, that's when I decided, oh yeah, this is for me. This feels like I have something to say here that is not, that has some integrity. But but I studied Russian language and literature and got my degree in college in Russian language and literature before then going briefly to Berklee College of Music to study jazz.
Well, Russian literature is the best, so it makes sense at the end of the day, you know. So let me ask you this. When you're incubating this dream of getting into this world of music, you have this idea of what it's going to be like. There's all these dreams that are kind of percolating around. Do you remember the first stage that you got on where you're like, wow, this is happening? Maybe a stage you dreamed that you would be on. Did you have a moment like that?
Well, you know, I had a moment like that, but I had no dreams. I mean, like my dream was I wanted to sing these songs because I thought they were cool.
Yeah.
And I loved it. That was my only dream. It was like, I wanted to work with good musicians and I wanted to sing these songs and I wanted to be able to sing these songs with great musicians. And I was able to do that fairly quickly. A couple things come to mind. The first kind of big one was I opened for the Max Roach Trio with a bunch of students who were in a program called Jazz in July at UMass Amherst. This is back when Max was, I think, on the faculty of UMass. And I didn't know him. I knew his son very well, who passed about a year and a half ago, Daryl Keith Roach. I became very close to him, but I never knew Max. But I remember it was the Bright Moments Festival, and they picked a couple of the groups that were in this program. And the teacher of that program was the great Sheila Jordan, who had a huge influence on me and was a mentor, my first real serious mentor in the music. So that was one time, and I thought, okay, but I think I didn't even realize what a big deal that was until years later, because I didn't really know who Max Roach was.
Yeah, right. You know?
I didn't really get it. I didn't really get it. So I didn't come into the music thinking, oh yeah, I want to do this. And no. I just wanted to play with people that I thought were great musicians. And that was a big dream. And I remember writing in my journal, when I moved to LA, there was a great bass player named Andy Simpkins, mm-hmm. who lived here, who played with Sarah Vaughan and all these people.
Yeah.
And I remember going to a jam session and Andy said to me, you know, Tierney, you're my favorite jazz singer in LA. And I wrote in my journal, I'm as successful as I ever want to be because Andy Simpkins said that I'm his favorite jazz singer in LA. So I've always felt those were my dreams, and those kinds of things have come true on a regular basis in their way. And those were the things that were most meaningful to me.
So you've been at this for a while. You're quite acclaimed. You get to travel the world. You're giving people this music. But what is it that you like the best about this life of being a musician? What gets you up? What allows you to evolve and to love and to embrace this world that's become your career?
Expedia and Visit Scotland invite you to come experience the beauty that awaits in Scotland. The sweep of wild coastlines, quiet locks and untamed landscapes. Fresh cuisine that feels rooted in the land. Come experience the kind of stillness that stays with you long after you leave. Plan your Scottish escape today at expedia.com/visitscotland.
Wow, you ask really, really nice questions, Joe. I would say it's the same thing. It's getting to play the music with great musicians. It's feeling like I'm able to offer some things that maybe people aren't familiar with, you know, an obscure Alan and Marilyn Bergman song that kind of only I know. Right now, I've been working on a project. The last 10 years of his life, Alan Bergman was wrote a series of 9 songs with Pat Metheny. And I introduced them because I had a conversation with Pat in 2012 about who had written lyrics for him that he really liked. And he said, no one. And I said, really? And I said, you know, I'm very close to Alan and Marilyn Bergman, and we talk a lot about the lost art of lyric writing. And his eyes lit up and he said, them, I want them to write lyrics for me. And I said, if you're serious, I can connect you. And so he wrote to Alan and Marilyn. By that time, Marilyn was kind of fading away from writing. She co-wrote the first song that they wrote together. And then after that, she wasn't writing, and it was just Alan. And so having this process of the last 10 to 15 years, well, actually, they didn't really get underway seriously until about 2015. So it was about the last 10 years of Alan's life. There was a series of songs, and I was very close to that process. And that, you know, to be a part of that, to be inside what Alan was doing, I got to sing all the demos, and I'll be singing one of the songs on the album that we're going to make. And, you know, that gets you up in the morning for sure. And I've also been writing my own lyrics, and the last several projects I've done have had some lyrics written by me, not the one with Tamir right now, but the last 2 records before that. And I'll keep writing lyrics, and you know, so it's just kind of, as I do it, I realize that the climate of my live shows is, for lack of a better word, kind of devotional, and people always comment on that, and that makes me really happy. So I feel like there's something that I have to offer now that I didn't have to offer 10, 15 years ago. And so that gets me up in the morning.
And speaking of time going by, you know, the beauty of the jazz world is that the elders have always been so good about imparting their wisdom and advice on the younger generations so that this torch continues to burn bright. What have you learned from the legends and luminaries in your career that you, in part, give to the younger people, the younger minds, to keep this art form vital and alive?
Well, I think about the first thing that Sheila taught me. And the first thing that Sheila taught me, which was the biggest thing, was that what you know or what you think you know about the music is not nearly as important as how kind you are to other people. And ultimately, we are here to sustain one another and to raise each other up. We're not here to tear anybody down. And Sheila treated students like tender plants that she was watering and nourishing. And I watched that process, and it was a really deep lesson for me.
Yeah. Yeah. She was a wonderful soul. I remember interviewing her once, and just, I couldn't imagine being in the same room with her. The amount of history and compassion, it just oozed from the phone line.
Oh, yeah. She was a soul, man. She was a very, very powerful, powerful woman. And I think of her a lot. But yes, I think that is one of the very great things about this music, is that there has been traditionally a reverence for the elders, you know. And now that I'm getting to be kind of one of them, it's, you know, what I'm finding now, which is really sweet, is that here and there, some of the young singers that I admire, that I think are just the bomb diggity, say very sweet things to me about how my early records influenced them. And that just makes me so happy, I can't even tell you, because, you know, that's just what we do. We're trying, we do our thing, and then we don't know if anybody really gives a damn. And then when you find that you've had even just a little influence on one of the great young talents that you admire, it's really a big deal for me. It makes me feel like, well, okay, my life, you know, wasn't a waste.
You know, it's, I think about that influence that musicians have. I moved to the hometown of Pat Metheny in 2020, Lee Summit, Missouri. And I think about how much we talk about Charlie Parker here, but I think Pat Metheny is just as paramount to the history. I mean, and the influence and huge. The love that he gets from everybody is unbelievable. And there was a book during that time that a local author named Carolyn Glenn Brewer wrote and talked about how he ran around in high school and all of that. And all the players that he was around, you know, before he moved on. And it was amazing. They were like, I don't even know how the kid went to school. He was playing and gigging all the time.
Well, actually, you know, when I think about Pat, that's a great, great example. Okay, so Pat's example to me is basically Pat's example as a human being. And I have two stories to tell about him, and they both have to do with respect for the elders and his profound respect for the elders. The first is, I went to his show, a show that he did, this has got to be, I don't remember what year Charlie Hayden passed, but this is probably within months of Charlie Hayden passing. And Pat was on a tour with his band that had, you know, shows every night and, you know, three in the LA area. And you've been to his shows, you know, they're like 2.5 hour shows. They're Olympic events.
Yeah.
And he does not kid around. And I went to see him at the Lobero Theater, where I've played many times, and went backstage. And it turned out that he had spent the afternoon visiting Charlie and spending time with Charlie. And this just frankly blew my mind, because I knew what kind of pace that tour was that he was on. And the fact that he would take the time out to go spend an afternoon with Charlie Hayden. When you're on the road and you're doing one-nighters like that at the rate that he was doing them, it is not a small thing. It is really difficult. And when I'm on the road, I almost have to be like a nun during the day. I can't be having lunch with people. And so that was the first thing. And I went, okay, this is a man. This is a human being. Yeah. Then the next thing was how he treated Alan and Marilyn, the care, the love, the effort that he made to make things easy for Alan, to send Alan the melodies that Alan would accept, the respect, and the respect that he showed by saying, hey, I don't like that lyric that you wrote in the second thing. I think it's not to the level of the first thing. And then Alan would be like, absolutely, I think you're right, let's go. I mean, it was such a thing. But I have photos of Pat meeting Alan and Marilyn for the first time at the same theater at the Lobero in Santa Barbara. And it was the last concert that Marilyn ever went to. And Pat invited me to come up and sing the first song that they wrote together with his trio, with his band, with just his quartet. And I have this beautiful picture of him kneeling down and holding Marilyn's hand. And she's in a wheelchair and Alan is standing behind. But the love and respect that he showed for them, it was like, this is Pat Metheny.
Yeah, right.
You know, like,
right.
I mean, you think he's going to be like the big cheese, but no, he knows exactly how to keep his eyes on the prize, which is about the music, which is about love for the ancestors and the people that have come before. So those are, you know, that's how I want to be.
That's wonderful. So why do you love this art form we call jazz?
Well, what I just told you is one reason.
Yeah.
I mean, but the other thing is, and this is another element, that when you're a musician like I am, which is kind of, you know, I'm not Pat Metheny. I don't, you know, I'm not playing, you know, 250 dates every year and have to turn them down and in the biggest halls in the world and all the rest of it. But what I get, which is really cool, is that every gig I do, every audience I'm with, every presenter that hires me is motivated by the music. Not because I'm famous, because I'm not. Not because they really know the work. And once you become a phenom, there's something of that that's lost.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And
yep.
So there's a sweetness about the world that I get to inhabit because of the sincerity of both my audiences and the presenters and the musicians that is very special, and it's kind of unique to jazz, I think.
Yeah. So let me dig just a little deeper here. Everyone has a perception of you, family, friends, fans, everyone on the bandstand, everyone in a business sense, but you run the show. What's your perception of you? Who do you think you are?
That I run the show?
You run the show for you. You run the id, ego, superego that all of us get a look at. What is your perception of what you put out into the world?
Wow, I have no idea. My perception is that I'm a crazy cat lady, and right now I'm a cat widow because I had my beloved cat for 17 years who went to the next world in November, and I am still not recovered.
Yeah.
And my husband told me today, we were talking, he's in Paris right now, and he said, you need to go and you need to get a kitten. You need to. So I'm kind of, so my perception of myself is I'm a crazy cat lady. I love music. The social media world is very hard for me to navigate. And I'm doing my best.
Yeah.
And it's hard. I think my generation and the generation older than me, this is hard for us because think of everything I've said about jazz and why I love it. So the idea of going online and saying, me, and I'm here, and this is my thing, and here's what I did today, and it was me, and then I did me, and then this person said they liked me.
Yeah.
It's like, oh my God. Yeah. It's just like anathema to my spiritual health.
Absolutely.
So it's very difficult. It's a very difficult period.
I get it. You know, I lost a really, really special cat years ago. His name was Dr. Kitty. He was this
Dr. Kitty.
He was this big, heavy mass, and he just lived like John Belushi or Jim. Yeah. And he just had this lifespan, and he was just gone. But I would just celebrate it because he had such a great existence. So my stepdaughter, who was at the time 13, wrote me a letter, talked to my wife, and she said, write him a letter and see if you can get a cat. So she went and got a cat, and his name's Loco. And I swear the spirit of Dr. Kitty is in this cat. And that's the beauty of, I think it's totally right to get a kitten. That transference of that cat energy, the nine lives, it's waiting for you. It's waiting to come back.
It's tricky. I mean, it's hard. I've had cats over the years, and because I'm on the road so much, the thing is that Buster was the... There are a couple things. You know, I had him from the time he was tiny. And he, I was his person from the beginning. And we adopted him with his sister. But he didn't want to be in a multi-cat household. He wanted to be the only one. And so when I got divorced from my ex-husband, who we had three cats together, and it was obvious Buster was mine, when I brought Buster to this house... Now this is like 15 years ago. He was like, yes.
Oh yeah.
Now we can talk.
That's it.
And it was like, now you are mine and there's no one else here. And it's not that annoying sister of mine. And I will be in your face and you will be mine and I will be yours. And we will make love constantly from now until I die.
Yep.
And that's what he did. And he would yell at me until I got into bed and he could purr and rub himself on me right here. It was the most ridiculous. I mean, there were boundaries that I should have set that my friends, when I would go on the road, I would get my friends to come over and cuddle him.
Yeah.
And And they would say, your cat has no boundaries, Tierney. You need to. And I'm like, no, I don't want him to have boundaries.
Right.
He doesn't need boundaries. Uh-huh. I like it just the way it is. And so, you know, I don't know that I'll ever have another Buster.
Yeah.
But I think you're right. I think there is. And for me, the thing is, this is going to sound crazy, but I don't think it's going to sound crazy to you. But for me, the love of an animal, a dog or a cat that you really, really bond with.
Where is Daredevil?
I'm right here.
Don't miss the return of Marvel Television's Daredevil Born Again.
So what's next?
I've been liberated.
We're gonna take this city back.
Over-medicated.
In an all-new season, now streaming only on Disney Plus.
They're hunting us. It's time we started hunting them.
I can work with that.
This should be tons of fun.
Marvel Television's Daredevil Born Again, now streaming only on Disney Plus.
It's something of the love of God.
Yeah.
It's something of the tenderness of the creation.
Uh-huh.
It's like the creation is giving you a personal hug.
Yep.
And so because they don't have free will the same way people do, it's a very profound experience.
Absolutely.
To have that with an animal. I think dog or cat.
Yep. I agree. I totally agree. So Spring is the new album. Any touring, anything going on right now that we can let everybody know about?
Well, let's see. We're going to be in LA this Tuesday, the 21st. Then the next thing is we go to Nashville for the Nashville Jazz Workshop on Friday. Then we go to Durham, North Carolina, the Sharp Nine on Saturday and Sunday. And then the next show we have is Denver. I think it's May 9th.
Okay.
We're going to be in New York at Smoke. And then there's a whole bunch of Northern California shows. We'll be at Wesleyan University at the end of May, my alma mater, where I first discovered jazz. And I'm getting to sing in the hall where I first discovered Betty Carter.
Wow.
With Benny Green in 1985-ish.
Wow.
And so that'll be really special.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of stuff. TierneySutton.com has everything. And
I will have all those links in the show notes. What a joy, Tierney. So great to meet you. Thank you so much for taking a minute out today. Best of luck with Spring and everything else and the cat adventures. So thank you.
Thank you so much. And if anybody has a fluffy, fluffy black kitten with white whiskers, preferably, but that's negotiable, let me know.
Thanks for listening and tuning in to another Neon Jazz interview, where we give you a bit of insight into the finest players and minds in LA, New York, Kansas City, and spots all over the globe, giving fans all that jazz. Thanks to Tierney for time and story. If you want to hear more Neon Jazz interviews, you can find us on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. Subscribe to us at YouTube. And for everything Neon Jazz, go to theneonjazz.blogspot.com. Until next time, enjoy the jazz, my friends.
Another spring. Neon Jazz.